From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with investigative reporter Jonathan Quitney. His new book, The Crimes of Patriots, alleges that a network of military and CIA men set up a bank in Australia to launder money for covert operations. Also today, I talk with theater critic and producer Robert Brustein. His new book of essays asks the question, who needs theater? Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Escarita, the man who taught Little Richard about the piano and the pompadour. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Making of the African Queen by Katharine Hepburn. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Quitney, an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His new book, The Crimes of Patriots, is an examination of the collapse of the Nugan Hand Bank, an international investment firm in Australia. According to Quitney, the bank was operated almost exclusively by retired CIA and United States military personnel engaged in a mammoth drug financing, money laundering, tax evading, investor fraud operation. He believes the bank was used as a CIA cover to finance operations as diverse as arms sales in Africa and the Middle East to the manipulation of Australian politics. Many of the central characters in Quitney's investigation have also come up in connection with the sale of arms to Iran and the diversion of those funds to the Contras, among them Air Force General Richard Secord and CIA officer Thomas Kleins. Like the Iran-Contra hearings, Quitney believes the story of the Nugan Hand Bank is one in which the cloak of patriotism was stretched to cover civil crimes against American citizens and citizens of other countries. Jonathan Quitney's earlier books include Endless Enemies, The Making of an Unfriendly World, which examines United States support of tyrants around the world, and Vicious Circles, The Mafia in the Marketplace, which explored mob infiltration into legitimate businesses. Jonathan Quitney joined The Wall Street Journal in 1973. His new book?
71.
71, okay. I stand corrected. And his new book is called The Crimes of Patriots. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The theory in your book is that this Australian bank, the Nugan Hand Bank, was really a cover to launder money and to help fund covert operations around the world. Give us one of the most compelling examples.
Well, the bank, to say it was a cover, it was started as a profit-making enterprise, I think, one of many in a long series over decades that are started by people who have had military intelligence backgrounds with the knowledge of the CIA and cooperation off and on. But basically is a profit-making enterprise, and they made profits by financing all kinds of criminal activities, drug running and illegal arms sales, the tax cheating, and they defrauded a lot of innocent investors.
Where does the CIA come in?
Well, a precise relationship, I think it's maybe confusing to people, the notion that an organization like that either is or isn't a CIA operation. Former CIA officer Victor Marchetti, who has gone public with a lot of the ways that the CIA works, has explained that there are several kinds of organizations. There are proprietaries, which the CIA owns and manages and which do certain functions for the CIA, like Air America was during Vietnam. It was an airline to handle the transportation needs. There are covers, which are companies set up that are owned by the CIA that serve no real function except to give an excuse for some spy being somewhere. And the third kind, which he said Nugan Hand was it would be a company that would be started by people who have military intelligence backgrounds, are known to the agency, are trusted by them, and that they know they can use when necessary. But on the other hand, they take no part in operating, and the people are kind of on their own. And this is the most dangerous kind, and it's the kind that really has, I think, become preeminent in recent years. And the Iran-Contra cases, Secord's companies, are a perfect example how with government imprimatur, private citizens can go around doing what they want with millions and millions of dollars, and a lot of illegal activity can be done in the same time.
How do you think the bank was financed?
Well, it was financed by the money of suckers who put their money into it. Although it claimed to have $1 or $2 million in seed capital, there really was no seed capital. The two founders of it, a former CIA operative named Michael Hand and an Australian lawyer he teamed up with, Frank Nugent, they floated a bunch of checks to make it look like they had invested a great deal of money in this, but there was no real money in it because it never did any real banking. It just claimed to. And it was written up in the financial press. It had a big reputation. It did business in 26 countries, including the United States. But all it ever did was, launder money for private citizens who wanted to engage in fraud against tax collectors, move money overseas for a lot of private citizens in third world countries who wanted to get large amounts of money out, and it was against the laws of their country to do so, from the Marcos family down to some small businessman in Thailand, move money for drug operators and other people who needed a secret cash moved, and then they sold these high-interest certificates of deposit. And people were told that they could put their money in and get 18-20% a year, and the money would be invested. And in fact, it wasn't. It was just taken.
Why was the bank in Australia? Was it because one of the founders of the bank lived there, or were the Australian banking laws receptive to the kind of bank that these guys set up?
Yeah. Again, I think it's not helpful to think of somebody sitting back in Langley, Virginia, and planning all this. Let's start this bank in Australia and run a lot of heroin and we'll finance other operations that way. I just don't think that happened or would happen. I don't think it's ever happened. I think some people in Australia, that was right after Vietnam, they had come from the Asian mainland, Indochina. Australia was an inviting place. And so a couple of them settled there and said, let's start this bank. We can make a lot of money. I think one of the original intentions was moving money out of the Asian mainland from a lot of these third world businessmen who were threatened with revolution or socialist government or just bureaucratic controls there. These people were known to the CIA, and it becomes a point of understanding. When necessary, the CIA's Australian counterpart helped them out with visas, for example. Top-level American officials, diplomats, CIA station chiefs would stop over and see them in Sydney coming through the Armed Services Committees, congressmen, senators, people from the Army and Navy War College, and then a bunch of generals and admirals signed on. Lieutenant General Leroy Manner, the former commander of our forces in the Philippines and who dealt personally with Marcos for the American government, ran the branch there. General Edwin Black, a former OSS man, close to Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, ran the office in Hawaii. He had also been chief of our forces in Thailand during Vietnam. Admiral Earl Yates, former director of planning for our entire Pacific Command, became president of the Nugent Hand Bank. William Colby, the former director of the CIA, became its lawyer. And there's a long list of other people.
Investigative reporter Jonathan Quitney is my guest, and his new book is titled The Crimes of Patriots. When the Iran-Contra story broke, did this open up new doors into your investigation?
Well, yeah. It put a new perspective on what I had done and allowed what I had done to, I think, give a new perspective that maybe people can understand as to how these things work, a perspective to the Iran-Contra affair. I had essentially finished a book last November about how there was this covert army of operatives overseas that for decades had been operating companies like this. I focused it largely on Nugent Hand as an illustration. And then suddenly, the same thing involving a lot of the same people is all over the front pages. And so by rewriting it, which I did madly through the course of the spring and on into July when it finally got yanked away from me and sent to the bindery, I was able to, I hope, show that the Iran-Contra affair was not something unique or something that happened because of mismanagement in the Reagan White House. It was part of a pattern of activity that had been going on for decades and that I think the American people have no idea has gone on, and that involves aiding and abetting crimes against Americans, from importing heroin into the United States to defrauding American citizens. And so by weaving those threads together, I hope there's a picture that will make it more difficult to sweep this current scandal under the rug by firing a few White House officials and saying they were inefficient. It has to do with basic policy.
Yeah, well, that reminds me of something that you write in the book. You write, the actors come and go. It's the roles that stay, and it's the roles that we need to be concerned with. What do you mean by the roles? What kinds of roles do
well,
you mean?
Well, again, to focus this on Oliver North buying snow tires or Donald Regan not arranging the president's appointments well enough would be to misunderstand what we're getting a look at. These kind of operations, private companies that are ripping off people while operating under the cover of American national security interests, and therefore their crimes are never going to be prosecuted. There's just a laundry list of these as long as your arm, and they go way, way back. And it's been our policy for 40 years or close to it to have operations like this. I think if you see this long list of operations and the kind of crimes they've committed, I think Americans may begin to ask themselves whether this is the way we want to run our country.
Your book is called The Crimes of Patriots, and you write about how a lot of the people involved in these extra-governmental operations see themselves as being patriots and as actually helping their country. But what do you think the percentage breakdown is of people who are really just in it for themselves and have purely selfish motives and know they do, and the people who really truly believe that finally this is going to help their country?
Okay, I think the covert operatives, the people who have been officials, Army men, Navy men, the generals, the admirals, the CIA people, really believe that they're doing this in the national interest. And I think Richard Secord is probably very genuine in telling himself he didn't really make money off of this. He did take money out to buy a Porsche, and he did have these hundreds of thousands of dollars at his disposal, but he had a right to make profits. I think you begin to rationalize this. On to this network that the United States has, our government has created this network, dispersed it around the world. On to this, every crook with any kind of international foresight knows that he can latch on to this network and have a very good chance that his criminal activities will not be prosecuted by the U.S. because if he is cooperating in alleged national security operations, they are not going to want the cover blown. And again, I have identified case after case of heroin smugglers. That seems to be the most colorful crime, but people who are committing every other manner of crime also, who latch on to the Contra effort, to the effort in Indochina, to whatever we're trying to do at the time, and their main interest is their criminal activity. But they know that by running a few errands for the CIA, they have provided a cover, and if anybody tries to investigate them, they're working for the government.
Do you think that an operation like this can be run by former military and CIA men without the help of the kind of crooks and shady underworld figures who usually do the gun running and the arms selling and the dope smuggling?
Well, I don't know that they're that much of a help, and I don't think these operations generally succeed. They turn out to be counterproductive in the long run. But if the question is whether we can run this kind of large-scale activity, where it's almost ludicrous to call it covert, for Operation Phoenix to have killed 40,000 people, it's hard to do that without the Vietnamese, the Russians, and almost everyone knowing that something's going on, to have a war in Nicaragua raising a large army. I don't see – well, rather than guess or prophesize, let's just say that on examining 40 years of history of our doing these things, there has never been an instance where they have kept away the nest of thieves and crooks and drug dealers who automatically latch on to these things. If it's possible to run this kind of operation without it becoming mired in criminal activity, nobody's found a way to do it yet.
My guest is Jonathan Quitney. He's an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and his new book, The Crimes of Patriots, explores the collapse of the Australian bank, the Nugan Hand Bank, and the role that retired CIA and U.S. military personnel played in that bank's operations. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Investigative reporter Jonathan Quitney is my guest, author of The Crimes of Patriots. Let's find out how you got onto this story. I don't think that the story that your book is about is one that most Americans have heard of or one that many reporters had written about before you got onto it. How did you first find out about this bank that had the CIA and American military connections?
Well, I read a lot and I'm interested in this kind of stuff, and so I had started a little clipping file on this bank when it went under, when the chairman's head was blown off in his Mercedes, and there was a bankruptcy where there were $50 million in claims and believed to be a lot more missing, and it was a bank that had all these generals, admirals, CIA people surrounding it. And it so happened that the editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal came back from Hong Kong to become the foreign editor of the journal in New York. And he had been very interested in this case, but he didn't have any reporters to spare over there to look into it. So he came to me and said, have I ever heard of this bank? And I said, sure, I've heard of this bank. And I pulled out a file. He said, you want to go over to Australia and Asia and find out what the heck happened? And I said, sure. And so I did.
How do you get people to talk to you when half of the people involved in this are operating pretty covertly?
Well, remember, the first thing is that there are an awful lot of people who were taken and very angry about being taken, and so you've got a ready-made base. Always start with the victims. Then once you get a body of information, you can go to the people involved. Also, the Australian government was very concerned with this. This Nugan Hand was a household name in Australia. It was the biggest scandal. It was comparable to Watergate. And there were a lot of investigative agencies over there, and they were getting stonewalled by the U.S. government, which would not release any information to them. And so they were very helpful, too. They were very frustrated, those investigators.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are times when journalists and law enforcement officials can work together and exchange information. And I was
almost—
As long
as it doesn't reveal confidential sources.
Yeah, I was almost surprised to hear you say that, though, that this kind of swapping of information.
Why? I think, I don't know, if they're honest and trying to do what they're doing, we're trying to get at the same end, and they often are frustrated when the real story occurs when the processes of justice don't work right. If all these guys had been immediately brought to heel, it would not have been the kind of story it is when nobody is prosecuted for what everybody has to concede are vast crimes, which are thoroughly documented. So sure, we work together, although there has to be a clear line that when people trust you, I mean, if people are talking to me, their names, their information, that's not going to be disclosed to the police, nor will the police disclose their informants to reporters.
I think one of the big issues you have to contend with when you're investigating such a big story with such underground connections is how much to make of the information that you find. What would be blowing something up out of proportion and what isn't? For instance, you go to Thailand, right outside of the Golden Triangle, and find out that the Drug Enforcement Agency and this bank share the same floor in an office building.
Basically the same office suite. It knocked me over. The secretary answered the phones for both of them, took messages for both of them. They worked together, socialized together. And why would you have a branch of an international bank in the Golden Triangle anyway if you weren't moving drug money? There's no other explanation for it. And then to come across thorough documentation that they were moving heroin money from one country to another in vast quantities for several different international syndicates involving the United States, something crazy was going on there. And then the DEA agents who were up at Chiang Mai is the name of the town in northwest Thailand, which is kind of the drug capital of the world. And the DEA agents, when I first went up there, were very intrigued by this. They had been wondering – they were all new and had been wondering what this bank had been up to and how this had come about. And they were very interested in my having interviewed a bunch of Thai citizens up there who had – according to the manager of the Nguyen branch, invested a lot of money there. But as soon as I started to talk to him, the American embassy put the kibosh on it, and the information officer from Bangkok issued orders that none of those drug agents were to talk to me anymore.
Is that usually a sign of a cover-up?
Well, you know, if the shoe fits.
So were you able to verify that there was any explicit connection between the Drug Enforcement Agency and the branch of this bank? Outside the Golden Triangle,
well, only what the facts will establish. They certainly knew each other. This drug enforcement agency would have known that this bank could have no other purpose but to deal in drug money in Chiang Mai, to share a receptionist, to socialize. They even shared business chit chat. I just was astounded.
Were you afraid before the Iran-Contra scandal broke that people wouldn't believe the story that you were telling?
Well, I saw it as a bit of a problem. I mean, I was struggling to tell people why they should care about this guy Richard Secord, and suddenly he's a household name.
Right. You know, but there are so many conspiracy theories where, you know, whether you're on the left, right, or center, everybody's got their favorite conspiracy theory, and they frequently involve either the mafia or the CIA. And you've written books investigating both. And I'm sure that there are people who, if it weren't for the fact that you are such an acclaimed investigative reporter and affiliated with the Wall Street Journal, who would just dismiss it when they heard a little bit about your investigation, thinking, oh, more conspiracy theory stuff.
Well, I think a lot of conspiracies tend to be confluences of interests, various people doing things because they're all interested in the same thing. And I think this kind of informal army that we've got of these covert operatives is kind of the same way. Again, I don't think that anybody ever sat down in Langley, Virginia, and said, let's start a big drug operation to finance our wars. And there are people who are saying that. This Christic Institute is saying that. But there is no evidence for it whatsoever. What happens is that people start private companies. They start covert wars. The drug dealers find them. And in every instance, they wind up trafficking in heroin or now it's Latin America, so it's cocaine. And the Contras have been heavily involved with drug dealers. And that also is detailed in the end of the Crimes of Patriots.
You've done a lot of your investigative work through the Wall Street Journal, and that's certainly how you did a lot of the story for the Crimes of Patriots. What are some of the problems that an investigative reporter like yourself faces when they're working for a newspaper? Are there any problems like that about do you ever want to go to press before your editor is ready? Or do you ever want to go deeper into a story than there's time for or money to fund?
Well, one of the wonderful things about working at the Wall Street Journal all these years has been that I've never heard anyone talk about not having enough time or money to do something that needed to be done. As for internal disagreements, I think that is appropriately left internal. I'm happy.
Okay. Do you think that the American press does a good job in investigative journalism, especially in the kind of international affairs?
Well, I'll tell you, the investigative stories come out. This whole Iran-Contra affair had been well covered for years. The problem is that they are run as kind of a unique unit, something separate, and the daily coverage goes on as if they didn't exist. We were told about this covert war in Nicaragua and basically who the cast of characters were. And yet, until the White House chose to recognize it last November because the jig was up and they were going to have to, daily coverage went on as if these exposés had not existed. And I think the press in general, has been far too compliant in letting the White House set its agenda and dictate what the news is. And I think this has gone on for many administrations, but the Reagan administration has been particularly adept at public relations control. I think they must be the envy of the Kremlin at times in the way they can manipulate the press.
I guess the television coverage of the hearings helped in terms of in increasing the American interest in the story, because all the leading figures become television characters as well as political characters.
Yeah, but on the other hand, they were very misleading for a lot of people. When you can get a guy like Oliver North, who confesses to having lied to practically everybody he ever talked to, he obviously will say whatever he thinks is useful at the time. He admitted lying to Secord, lying to the Iranians, lying to practically everybody, and yet the whole country thought he was telling the truth to them. I think they made a fundamental mistake at the very beginning when they set ground rules whereby they would not question the propriety of the policy. They would only question the propriety of the process by which the policy was implemented. And yet the witnesses were invited and allowed to say anything they pleased. So what happened was witnesses could talk on and on about the freedom-loving freedom fighters and so forth. And the committee was sitting on these documents which talk about dope dealing, corruption, these people can't be trusted, the Contras, they're awful people. And yet they couldn't ask, they had set rules by which they never asked about that, so it never came out.
Are you protective of your territory when you're investigating a story? And do you always hope that there won't be an investigative reporter from another paper looking into the same story that you are?
Well, you want to get something first, because that really is the payoff to the paper or publisher for supporting you. I mean, they're paying this money, and if you don't come back with – I mean, if somebody else beats you to it, it's – not worth as much as far as readership excitement goes. But I try to cooperate with other reporters when possible, and I think the important thing is that the truth come out one way or another.
What are the major questions you have now about the Iran-Contra story?
Well, I'm dying to know what Judge Walsh is going to come down with in the way of indictments, and I think it's important to see whether Congress is going to try, as I'm afraid they will, to pass this off as mismanagement by one administration rather than get at the core of the problem, because they never went into the criminal activity that's been done in the name of the Contra War except by the White House operatives. And if they're going to ignore the long decades of history of exactly this going on with the major heroin importing networks into the United States since World War II being the inadvertent byproduct of our intelligence operations. If they're going to ignore this, then we will have gained nothing by it.
Jonathan Quitney, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been investigative journalist Jonathan Quitney. He writes for The Wall Street Journal and is the author of the new book, The Crimes of Patriots, which explores the involvement of retired CIA and U.S. military personnel in an Australian bank, a now-collapsed bank. There are parallels in this story to the story of the Iran-Contra affair. The Crimes of Patriots is published by Norton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Shirley MacLaine, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, theater critic and producer Robert Brustein talks about his lifelong involvement with the American stage. His new book, Who Needs Theater, is a collection of essays and reviews. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward answers the musical question, where in the world did Little Richard learn to act so outrageous? And book critic John Leonard reviews The Making of the African Queen, Katharine Hepburn's remembrance of the 1951 film classic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Before many of the all-time greats of rock and roll, before Little Richard, before James Brown, before Jerry Lee Lewis, there was Esker Rita. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the man that Screamin' Jay Hawkins said was the devil.
Rock and roll has provided a living for some people on the margins of society, and while they may not be the most vital rock and roll artists, their stories have a fascination all their own. People hear a record and get hooked, and then they have to know more. Perhaps one of the strangest rock and roll stories of all time was Esker Rita. For years, the few of us who knew of his existence brushed him off as a Little Richard imitator, but the truth is even stranger than that. Record like that one, Hey Miss Lucy, sounds like a Xerox copy of a Little Richard record. And indeed, it was made in 1958 when Richard was hot. But hold on. A couple of years ago, Little Richard wrote his autobiography. And as he recounted the story of his early days as a mediocre blues singer, he says, "It was around this time that I learned to play the piano." And who taught him? A gay guy, he says, a piano player named Esker Rita. At the time, Esker Rita was working with a lady evangelist who sold blessed bread. He was based in Greenville, North Carolina, where he played with gospel singers like Clara Ward and Brother Joe May. And when Richard heard him in 1951, Esker Rita was devoting part of his time to gospel and part to the circuit of Southern black gay bars. Richard says in his autobiography that he thinks Esker Rita was a better piano player than Jerry Lee Lewis or Stevie Wonder, and back then he very well may have been. One thing is for certain, he gave Richard two things, his piano style and his hairstyle. And Richard, never one to fail to take credit for something, admits it. In 1958, Capitol Records was trying to catch up with rock and roll. They'd signed their version of Elvis, Gene Vincent, and were looking for more. Gene Vincent's guitarist, Paul Peek, was from Greenville, and at the Owl Club there, he saw Esker Rita. He took him to a local radio station, cut some demo records, and played them for Capitol in Hollywood. They signed him instantly, sent him to Nashville to record, and released Rockin' the Joint as a single.
Everybody was a rockin' with me.
By this time, Escarita's piano playing was more enthusiastic than accurate, and the record sounded too much like Richard. He was dropped the next year, moved to New Orleans, where he performed at the infamous Dewdrop Inn, and continued to record. 25 years later, he was a legend. In New York, Billy Miller, who puts out Kix magazine, discovered that Escarita had been booked into Tramps, a blues club. Although Escarita was very paranoid, due in part to his drug consumption, he managed to trust Billy enough to tell him that his real name was S.Q. Reeder, Jr., that he'd spent some time in jail, had one eye, and that he was ready to become famous again. It never happened. Escarita was too unpredictable, too unreliable, and Billy says he was mixed up in some questionable stuff. Early last year, he developed pneumonia as a complication of AIDS. He died last October, unknown except to a handful of us who had been mesmerized not by his Little Richard soundalikes, but by this record, something he tossed off in the studio. He called it Escarita and the Vula. Escarita and the Vula, recorded in 1958. I'd like to thank Gary Mollica and Billy Miller for research assistance on this piece.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is theater critic and producer Robert Brustein. He's worked in various aspects of the theater as an actor, director, producer, teacher, and critic. He founded the American Repertory Theater, now housed at Harvard University, and was the dean of the Yale Drama School, where he formed the Yale Repertory Theater. He's been writing about theater for the New Republic since 1959. He's collected some of his essays and reviews in a new book called Who Needs Theater? In it, he discusses topics ranging from theater history to regional theater, the British invasion, contemporary playwrights, and Broadway. I asked him about the state of American theater criticism today.
Criticism is always meant to be interpretive, supportive or non-supportive, as the case may be, but right now it seems to have turned into a kind of consumer's guide in New York where critics tell the public whether they should spend their money or not. And as a result, it's not doing people in the theater any good. And in the long run, it's really not doing the public any good.
A lot of theater reviews end up closing the performance if it's a bad review. Is there a way, do you think, to write a critical review yet to not close down a performance if you think the show is bad?
I think there's one very significant way, which is not to write for the New York Times. I mean, I was once offered that job, and I turned it down simply because I could not see myself as someone responsible for the employment or unemployment of large numbers of people who had put a great deal of time, effort, and artistry into creating a work. But in my more out of the way post on the New Republic, I don't affect the run of a play, so I have the luxury, a luxury not enjoyed by my friend on the New York Times, I'm afraid, of just talking about the nature of the play and how it fits into the nature of other plays and possibly even theater history. It's a more reflective kind of criticism than the hot day after kind of criticism is judgmental criticism is permitted to do.
So you want to write for a periodical that doesn't affect the box office?
I choose that purposely, and I try to proselytize among my own colleagues and fellow artists for refusing celebrity. That celebrity seems to me one of the most dire and malignant qualities of American life on the American artist.
Why do you think becoming a celebrity is such a dangerous thing?
Because you keep trying to repeat the conditions that made you a celebrity instead of repeating the conditions that made you an artist. And as a result, you tend to either repeat your past successes or to get more and more in the form of novelty, creating more and more novelty in order to capture the attention you once had. So you're not really looking at the thing itself, which is the object, the art object. You're looking at all the conditions around the art object, namely your place in cultural society.
Your critics have described you as being anti-Broadway.
As far as being anti-Broadway is concerned, I really am. I won't accept that appellation because there are things I've seen on Broadway that fill me with great exaltation. They don't happen very often, but they do happen from time to time. I think you might say I am anti the Broadway system, which I don't think has proved, and what's happened on Broadway in recent years is confirmation of my point, has proved to be a very good breeding grounds for talent. I think it's a killing grounds for talent. And a lot of very good people have left the theater, unfortunately, and gone into films and television where they can be safer and more secure and more shielded, as it were, from the killing conditions of Broadway.
Do you think the future of American theater is in regional theater? And I should say here, you hate the expression regional theater. You prefer nonprofit resident theater.
I think the word regional implies a certain provincialism, whereas the resident theaters actually are far from provincial. While they create their programs for their audiences, as you know, a large number of the things they've done have gone on to other venues. My own theater, for example, travels extensively nationally and internationally to all the festivals. So I don't like the word regional for that reason. I don't like the word tributary theater either, because, or the phrase tributary theater, because it seems to imply that the resident theater organizes its work in some backwater in order to float down the river towards Broadway. And that's not its purpose, or I'm afraid it's sometimes it is its purpose, and that shocks me and upsets me.
Let's get to some of your opinions that you've given in reviews that you've written in the New Republic. You called Children of a Lesser God, which was very successful on Broadway and then became a very successful film, you called it the play you're not allowed to hate. Why not?
Well, I saw it as a kind of subgenre of a large number of plays which formulate themselves in such a way that criticism is, as it were, baffled before it, and the public feels required to applaud it, even though they may feel in their hearts that it's a pretty rotten play. And because it has to, it deals with certain important and necessary issues of the time. The way it deals with those issues, quite often, is banal and sentimental and soporific. It's very hard for criticism to criticize the major issue when it's dealing with the individual issue, which is the play itself and how effectively it's confronting these problems.
So you could be accused of being heartless for not liking a show like that.
Exactly, and I often have to represent myself as heartless because I don't like a lot of those shows.
Do you think there's a parallel that can be made between made-for-TV movies and Broadway in the sense that they're really involved in message stories now, stories with a message?
I think a lot of our theater does tend to fall into that dump, and it's most easily available, I think, to the audience. And people like to go away from the theater feeling good about themselves and good about their attitude. towards whatever the inferior form of being on the stage they've watched, but it is a form of condescension. I remember even as good a play as Nicholas Nickleby ends up with this incredibly self-righteous parade in which the audience goes away feeling that they have somehow participated in some magnificent affirmation of benevolence, and then they walk out of the theater right past people sitting in doorways with their heads down, drugged out. They do nothing about them. They do nothing about the problems of black inequality. They do nothing about discrimination towards homosexuals. It's just a question of feeling good in the theater.
When you went to see Laurie Anderson's New Wave multimedia show, it led you to think about the new marriage between modernism and the media. Would you describe the marriage that you were thinking of?
I think in order to sell newspapers and magazines that it's imperative for critics and cultural commentators to identify new geniuses every week. And quite often they are identifying very talented people, but it seems to be one of the problems of our culture that the only two stories worth writing about are success and failure. So after you've identified the success, you turn around and announce the failure and look for the next genius. And this does not allow any talent, really, the opportunity to develop in peace and quiet the way talent has always developed in the past.
So you think artists profit in the short run by lots of media attention, but in the long run, they might lose out?
I think in the short run, they lose out, too. I don't know what good it does them except to solve their vanity and their egos, but it doesn't help with the development of their art.
One last thing. You've described yourself as wanting to write criticism that puts the theater into some kind of context instead of just being a consumer's guide. This is good, spend your money. This is bad, don't go. Have you ever gotten reviews of your productions that you felt you really learned from?
Yes, I have. I must say it's rare. But I have had reviews of that kind, and I cherish them. But for the most part, as Jan Kott once said, you know, someone reviews a play and you don't know about the reviewer, you don't know where he stands on sexual issues, political issues. You don't know anything about the person. They're sitting there in some removed height, simply judging things without giving you any of their credentials. In most cases, they don't have credentials for criticism. They just have an opinion. And one of the strongest things, one of the strongest points I try to make in the book is that opinions in regard to artistic objects are virtually worthless. That if the opinion does not come out of a profound conviction, whether it's a social or political or metaphysical or religious conviction about where that play sits in the larger order of the universe, then this criticism is going to be very disposable and is very disposable.
Robert Brustein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Robert Brustein's new collection of essays and reviews is called Who Needs Theater, and it's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What are some of the stories you're following?
Tonight on All Things Considered, we visit a small town in the Midwest, Waseca, Minnesota. Its population is 8,000. Reporter David Wellna goes back to his hometown to talk with a childhood friend who has also returned to Waseca, but he has AIDS. He's a high school basketball star. He attends his school reunion, and we hear how classmates, townspeople, the school nurse, everyone there react to him, his homosexuality, and also his illness. Also, we talk to the author of the new book, Time Wars. Time Wars theorizes that time will be the next great battleground politically.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of late director John Huston's most memorable films is The African Queen. Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn starred as a hard-drinking river rat and a prim missionary who travel up the Congo in 1915. Bogart won an Oscar for his performance. Instead of relying entirely on Hollywood, Huston shot some of the film on location in Africa. Katharine Hepburn's just written a book about that experience. Critic John Leonard has a review.
John Huston died before reading Katharine Hepburn's Valentine to him, and that's a shame. Hepburn spent 3 months in 1951 in darkest Africa, in the Congo and Uganda, with Huston and Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, making the African Queen. And she remembers every minute of it as if it had just happened late last night in the middle of a nightmare of rain and mosquitoes and producers and snakes and elephants and ants and crocodiles, when all she really wanted to do was to go to the bathroom. A crocodile, she tells us, is an animal simply without charm. And the elephants, determined not to get shot by Huston, almost trampled her to death. Although the hippopotami reminded her of teddy bears, and the antelope were good to eat, and she would finally decide Huston wasn't a lunatic after all. Her description of him, in fact, is better than most photographs, which is saying something because the 47 photographs accompanying her text are very good indeed. But listen. He has a ridiculous but distinguished face, flat pointed ears like Pan. His hair is always too long about the edges, thin Irish skin, black deep-set eyes, black beetle brows and two long hairs straying out of the left one. His nose is pointed and quite nostrilled. He laughs a lot. He has wonderful even teeth. The lower ones are apt to be tobacco-stained. His face is quite lined. He has a noble chin. He has a very thin neck, definitely of the bird family. His chest caves in and his stomach sticks out. Stands, sits, lies in a stooped position. Never breathes. His strong wrists and strong hands are like a young boy's. And wonderful feet, fine ankles. Hepburn remembers all this decades later, talking into a tape recorder, smoking too much, sounding so very much like the person we want her to be that she seems like a favorite fictional character. She's caustic, but mostly about herself, her hair, her body plumbing, and the creature comforts she didn't quite forsake just because she wanted to go to Africa and work with Bogart. She hadn't really liked the script, and rather wished Bacall, along for the ride and also to make lunch, weren't so young and beautiful. Hepburn was 41 back then. There's a snapshot of a bare-legged Bacall with Bogie that'll knock your socks off. And Huston was never around when he promised, off instead great white hunting, or boozing with the boys, or contemplating a broken propeller. But then he shows up after the first day's shooting and asks her to try, quote, putting on a society smile, whatever the situation, like Mrs. Roosevelt. Chin up, the best is yet to come, onward ever onward. It was, says Hepburn, the goddamnedest best piece of direction I have ever heard. I was his from there on in. The making of The African Queen is full of movie-making tidbits, territorial imperatives, money and servant problems, surgical sketches of small towns and exploding engines and improbable golf games and solitary breakfasts. But its abiding charm is Hepburn's imperial sassy tone of voice, the lady and the smart aleck and the serious actress who never made a trashy movie and the coltish giddy lover of Spencer Tracy, every bit as much an American princess as Grace Kelly, and better than Grace in the original version of the Philadelphia Story. No one else can wear a hat or tell a story like her, and this delicious morsel makes us greedy for the big meat-and-potatoes autobiography she has so far refused to write. Ladies keep secrets.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The African Queen by Katharine Hepburn, published by Knopf. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with retired Colonel Joe Comney. He served as technical advisor to the new Vietnam film, Hamburger Hill, helping to stage the reenactment of a battle he helped lead. On the anniversary of the death of prima donna Maria Callas, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new video cassette of two of Callas' television performances. And guest commentator Jan Harald Brunvann will trace the etymology of the expression, a bug in your ear. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.